Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour, episode number 3, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news, reviews and opinions. My name's Dan Wood.
I'm Ravi Abbott.
And this week we are joined by Joe Fox. Hello, Joe.
Hello, Dan. Thank you for having me today.
Hey,
now,
Joe.
Joe's been a mate of mine for years now, and you know we often have retro gaming nights, and I have been known to have the odd rage quit when Joe beats me at games.
Yeah, the odd scranny, that happens almost every week.
We had a road trip to the Winter Warmer.
We did, didn't we?
We did, yeah. The first time I met Ravi.
You won't shake him off now.
Yeah, that's it.
So what kind of systems did you grow up with then, Joe?
So I grew up with a Sega Mega Drive. I was born, we had one in the household, and that was mine and my older brother's baby. So Mega Drive all the way, and then my uncle, my auntie and my cousins all had a Super Nintendo, so kind of grew up in the 16-bit era.
Excellent. Well, great to have you on the show, Joe.
Cheers.
And,
thank you again.
Speaking of guests as well, a little bit later, every week on the show we do have someone who's pretty high profile in the world of video games, and this week, what a guest you've lined up for us, Ravi.
Yeah, we've got Paul Jury, an old friend of mine that actually works on Retro Gamer magazine, and he lectures in video game journalism, so he's a really, really smart guy who's been around for a long time, so he can have some great stories.
He's on the Bedroom Stabilions documentary as
well.
Yeah,
he's featured on that as well.
So he'll be on in about 35, 40 minutes. Before then, though, should we crack on with this week's big retro stories?
Yeah, let's roll.
Now, the first one, have you heard of a game called I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream?
Yes.
No.
50-50 down the floor here. So
based on a book.
It was, yeah.
From the 60s.
Who wrote the book?
I believe it was
Harlan Ellison.
There we go.
Yeah,
now, 1968.
Have you played the game?
No, I haven't. I've read about it and watched reviews and watched a trailer for the new version of it. But I've not played it myself, but I understand it's a point and click.
It is, yeah. Well, this is a story that now they're bringing it out on iOS and Android. Now, this was a game that came out, I think it was about 1995.
Yeah.
And it was a point-and-click game. The thing about it is the book is really surreal, and it's based on, basically, humanity's had a Cold War, and then they've given supercomputers. It's a bit like Terminator, really. So then these supercomputers have taken over the world. Most of humanity's died off, and one of the computers has become self-aware.
Okay.
And that machine's called Am. And what it wants to do is it keeps, like, 5 humans alive, and it wants to torture them and just make their lives hell because it hates humans. So basically, this game, it's an unbeatable video game. There's no way of winning it at all.
Oh.
The decisions you make in the game either choose whether you have a worthwhile and, like, you know, a pleasant death, or whether it's kind of,
so,
like, really messed up.
So the aim is to die the least possible worst way.
Yeah, in the least horrible way, essentially, yeah, so... And it was a game that came out back in the mid-90s, but the fact they're bringing it out now on iOS and Android, so, you know...
Touchscreen.
Rather than playing Candy Crush on the train, you can play a game about torturous death.
Torturous death. Hopefully you don't get don't get killed too badly.
Sounds really dark, but interesting.
Yeah, so, for as little as $2.99, I believe.
Yeah, so not a bad price. You know, it's worth a go just for being, you know, a unique, you know, innovation that you can't actually win this game. So links will be in the show notes like we do every week. Another thing I was reading this week as well is an article that was in Game Noir magazine, and there was a video I watched as well that I've been trying to find, and I can't find it for the life of me. But basically, the topic is, why do we call it retro gaming?
Mm.
If you watch an old movie, for example, we don't call it retro movieing.
No, it's like classic cinema, isn't
it?
Yeah.
Or if you listen to, like, you know, an old song, it's not, you're not listening, you know.
You don't even class it as, like, yeah, you don't really say what year it came out or anything, but it's a big deal with gaming, isn't it?
So. Would you call it, like, you know, retro musicking if you're listening to, like, 80s music or whatever, you know what I mean? It does make an interesting point why gaming, you know, is pretty unique, the fact that it's got that retro prefix before it.
I think maybe they also, in the 90s, they had this whole next generation thing. Which was,
super,
you know,
consoles.
Yeah,
super
so consoles. Maybe everything pre that is next generation. But some people are saying, like, Xbox 360's retro.
No,
that's a really good question. When does it become retro gaming? When do you say this is retro? Because you see, like, Guitar Hero, and people go, oh, yeah, that's retro gaming. And you go, well, no, it's not. But then you realise it came out 10 years ago, the first one. So you're like, when's the cut-off point? When's the start point to call it retro?
Well, do you ever go on 4chan? Have got a retro gaming page on there. And it's really weird, though. They class the Dreamcast as retro, but nothing else from the sixth generation.
Yeah, so what about PS2?
Yeah, they don't class that. I think it's because you have a cut-off of 1999.
Yeah.
But then a lot of them on there, like, you know, that the PS2 will never be considered retro because it came out this century, so...
But then there's also vintage gaming. And whenever I hear vintage gaming, I think of Atari.
I think of the Odyssey, like the wood era of the 70s.
Yeah. It's not wood grain, isn't it? Yeah. Not vintage.
But it's not vintage.
But I think one of the reasons that it does get that prefix attached, though, is because it's such a fast-moving industry, though, as well, isn't it? You know, you look at music and films and obviously films look different now to what they did 30 years ago, but I think, you know, you even look 5 years ago in gaming, it develops a lot quicker, so...
Yeah.
And I guess it's who's calling it retro. Mm-hmm. You know, if you've got a little kid, then everything's going to be retro to them.
Yeah.
But with us, it's... You know.
Yeah.
The 3DS, how retro, Dad?
Oh, talking of that, they've just actually released a 2DS limited edition version.
Okay.
Because of Pokemon.
Oh, I've seen that. That's definitely up my street. I'm like... You know, I was almost with Majora's Mask for the 3DS, but now Pokemon, I might have to get one.
Going back to the 2DS. That's,
for the 2DS.
I've got a 3DS, where it's actually Samantha's my missus. She never plays in it, though. Literally, the only time we ever use it is when we're going away. So I'll be on the plane, I'll be playing, like, you know, 3D Ridge Racer and all that, but then she gets a bit annoyed, like, you haven't spoken to me for like 4 hours now, and I'm like, headphones in, what?
Well, a good mention of Ridge Racer, actually, segues us onto our next story.
Just throw this together, come on.
Yeah, that's it. Which is a patent of loading screens expires.
Yes.
Now, this is loading screen games. So if you ever remember on the PlayStation 1, Ridge Racer, any Namco kind of titles.
Tekken 1,
yes. Yep. You could play these little games on the start screen. That was actually patented by Namco.
Even Ridge Racer 7, I think, on the PS3.
Oh, really?
Has that as well, yeah.
As you say, I only ever saw it on Ridge Racer and Tekken 1. That's the only time I've ever seen them. Mm. Otherwise, they've just kind of been, maybe you can move something on the loading screen, but that'll be it.
I think you can play like Pac-Man or something on the PS3 one. Yeah, that's a Namco game, isn't it?
Well, after 20 years now, that's expired.
So, but they had an exclusive on a video game playing while your main game's loading up. Okay, interesting.
So if you look at games like recently, they have the Elder Scrolls, Skyrim and stuff. They've tried to have had to have nice visual displays in the loading screens.
That's what I was saying. Fallout 4, and they've done it on that as well, haven't they?
Yeah, or tips and hints that pop up, but you can never actually play a game whilst it's going on.
Well, I think now, because a lot of games, you know, even the new consoles, you've got to install everything on the hard disk now. So loading times are, they're meant to be a bit quicker, but then the games get bigger anyway. So sometimes I'll be playing Ridge Racer and I'll be playing Pac-Man for like 20 minutes and be like, I can't be asked to play the full game now.
Well, funny if you should mention that, because with Galaga for Tekken, if you actually completed that without missing any of the insects, the aliens, whatever they were, you actually unlocked a hidden character.
Oh, in the main game?
In the main game, and you could play as Devil. Who was Kazuya's like alternative like being, if you will, and you could play as Devil in the main game as Tekken. Never achieved it, but no, it's just
this is why we need Joe, man. He's got some good knowledge.
So you could actually, you know, spend many hours trying to complete Galaga 100% on your accuracy as well, and you'd unlock this hidden character, but you know, it was solid as hell, so it never happened as a child.
Well, I think also, like, you know, games like FIFA, they've had the goal scoring at the beginning of the game. Assassin's Creed, you can just run around in that space, you know. Mm-hmm. And now that this patent's gone, there's going to be some real innovative stuff that's going to start coming out. Yeah,
for 2016.
It's amazing what you can patent, though, isn't it?
Yeah. You know, the left click or
OJ.
And there's something that's coming back that you may remember from your teenage years.
Yes, it's Robot Wars.
Oh, back on the telly.
Yeah. Now, if you're listening in America, you may not know about Robot Wars. I don't know if they did it in America.
I'm not sure.
There must be.
It's a very British thing.
Yeah, it was basically groups of nerds, often with their young kid who was coming along because they'd told him it was exciting, and they would build these kind of giant robots with spinning discs and stuff to fight each other.
I mean, I always wondered what the restrictions were with the robots.
Some of the flamethrowers and all that, didn't they?
If he's got a flamethrower, I want to shoot bees.
Didn't they do like a late night version of it as well?
I'm sure there's Robot Wars really Extreme.
Yeah, I heard about that.
Yeah, and that was like flamethrowers.
But
and
then
like
it got crazy. They had like a referee bot in there and stuff, and they'd have pits that, you know, people would fall in.
And there is some proper nerd. You can almost smell these guys through the TV, can't you?
you can see the sweat on his forehead. Spent 5 years making it for it to be destroyed in 30 seconds.
It was a really innovative show as well. And here, actually, Bluetooth have said Bluetooth is ideal for Robot Wars. And also Raspberry Pi have said that they're very happy because they want to start making brains for these robots. So
rather than remote control, there'll be AI.
You know, these educational toys are turning into deaf machine brains.
Have it just go mental and walk off into the audience or something. Destroy humans.
You know what? I actually read that they were going to make the arena bulletproof. So I don't know. Like, maybe it would.
They had pneumatic rams. They had cutting discs and stuff. So maybe there might be bullets.
Taking it up a notch, yeah. Here we have Sir Killalot with his M16.
Yeah, I might watch that one on TV, but not necessarily get tickets to see the live show, I don't think. Yeah.
I'd love to see one of those malfunction.
Now, we mentioned things that are coming back, things that are kind of degrading, I suppose. They've made Mortal Kombat for the Atari 2600.
Yes, so we've been talking about remakes. This is demakes. So basically, a few years ago, they did a Halo 2600, which was Halo on the Atari 2600. Very small, but it looked really good. You could do pickups of weapons, and if it actually came out at the time, I think it would have been really popular. But now they've done Mortal Kombat, and just by the shots of it,
it looks quite interesting. I'm having a look at a video of it now on YouTube, and the text looks good. Scorpion doesn't look good.
I wonder if they've got the vocal effects.
It looks more like Mortal Kombat Anthologies, the Sub-Zero game. It looks more like a platformer, but... You know, it does look like Mortal Kombat, though.
I mean, you know, for the 2600, having graphics that you can actually make out what they are is quite an achievement, actually.
If you have a look, it does look like Mortal Kombat. You can clearly tell it's Scorpion. So.
And I think they would probably have an intro as well, because the Halo one, they had the Halo ring and the music. But in Atari, it was amazing.
Might even have an intro game.
Well, yeah, they had produced carts as well.
I remember seeing they ported Doom to the Commodore VIC-20.
Yeah,
because these platforms are so old now, you didn't get stuff like that when they were new because the developers were still learning how it worked and what you can do with it. But now, people are pushing these old platforms way beyond what they're ever designed to do, and they know every trick in the book now.
Also, I think people can charge quite a lot for these games, you know, because old school guys are going to want, you know.
And as nerds, you know, we have nothing better to spend money on, so we're going to buy it.
I'm just waiting for Grand Theft Auto.
Grand Theft Auto 2600, And there's another game as well that's just had a release, a classic game.
Well, yeah, this is, it's actually a level off Doom. So this is his first Doom level that John Romero created, who was the creator of Doom. Mm-hmm. And, you know, last week we talked about how they were releasing loads of stuff from ID Software, the old Mario, Super Mario games. Well, it looks like they've been looking through their folders at home and they've released the WAD file for it.
Yeah, I'm just looking at it here and it's the first time he's worked on it in 21 years, apparently.
Really?
Yeah, so 21 years is the first for him for this game, for Doom.
And he used Doom Builder 2 for it. Which was maybe some kind of construction kit that came out for Doom early on.
I remember when Doom first came out, there was a shareware game, wasn't it, originally?
Before
a commercial game.
You had to order it, didn't you?
Well, that was really the thing that kind of really kicked off PC gaming, made the PC a viable platform, really.
I think it was also because they could distribute it so well on BBSs, because it was a shareware game, that it could just spread so fast, far and wide.
Well,
that format stayed until, because they did that with Duke Nukem as well. That was shareware, wasn't it? And they kind of kept that shareware first-person shooter distribution thing going for a while.
So obviously, there's Wolfenstein 3D before that, but I remember the first time
shareware.
It was, I remember it was the same crew, wasn't it? But I remember the first time I saw Doom was in Ryman's, the stationery shop. They used to sell, like, you know, they had old PCs and stuff. Yeah. And my friends would go in there on a Saturday, you know, because we're like rebels. So we'd like go in there, all shopping in town. We're just like, you know, they had Doom loaded up on one and like must have been there about 3 hours. They had to kick us out of the shop.
But I guess that kind of maybe big publishers wouldn't have taken on such a controversial thing or a game where you're killing Nazis or, you know, you're in hell, you know. So.
Yeah.
Maybe to get it out there.
It's a bit strange. I mean, funny, going back to what Dan just said, my first experience of Doom was on the PS1 playing it in Toys R Us, which, of all places, and I remember playing it with my older brother and thinking this is the most, I must have been about 5 years old or something, it was the most brutal thing I'd ever seen. And, I thought it was Bruce Willis on the cover, but it wasn't, obviously. But I remember thinking...
I'd like to see that, though.
We were in Toys R Us, and it was Doom 1 and 2 for the PS1, because you got it in the double pack, in the big box. And that's my first memory of it in Toys R Us, of all places.
Mine was the banging soundtrack.
Just hearing
that, because I actually heard that before I saw the game, because people were in front of it. Mm-hmm. But it was like, oh my God.
What is that? What is that fist-pumping music?
Yeah. But being, you know, for me, that was when the smugness of being an Amiga user went, when Doom came out. Because at school, I had, like, you know, an Amiga 500 Plus, and my friend Mandip, his name was, he had a PC. And, like, he'd have, like, ports of, you know, obviously the games have come out on lots of different platforms, but he'd often have, he didn't have a sound card, so it was like the built-in PC bleepy speaker, and it was like, you know, EGA graphics and that kind of thing. And he'd come over and look at the Amiga, and they'd have like proper stereo soundtrack, and he'd be like, oh my God, it sounds so good. And then like he got a new PC, and like he goes, yeah, I've got Doom, by the way. And I was like,
that's it. Well, talking of that, there's an amazing video by a guy called Ahoy on YouTube, which is Doomed, the Embers of Amiga FPS. And it's basically talking about all the Amiga attempts to do Doom until we actually got it ported.
Yeah, they did, but not until about 97 or something, wasn't it? Came out on the Amiga.
But I don't know when. I mean, I'm sure they were still porting Doom until a couple of years ago.
Oh, we were saying last week it's on like some new platform.
Really?
Well, not a platform.
Oscilloscope, isn't it?
Yeah. That's it.
Playing a toaster now as well, I think. Yeah.
It's on my watch. Well, you probably can these days.
Yeah, iWatch. But yeah, obviously a legendary game. It's very interesting to see something new coming out from John Romero, though. That'll be
I reckon he's probably looking back at his past and stuff, and kind of searching through stuff. But you know what would be cool, though?
Mm-hmm.
Imagine the little Doom face on your iWatch. So kind of
melting away. Yeah.
When you're at the gym and it's melting away. When you're on that treadmill.
The gym. Now, speaking of things from the past that are now back, I thought this is quite interesting. There's been a load of 1980s internal Atari emails released.
Oh, I've not heard of this.
So what it is, it's basically an archive. They used to use these things called VAX servers. So a lot of companies back in like the 70s and 80s used these as like internal email servers, and someone's done like a tape backup. And you can actually go through and look at all of these internal memos and emails that were getting distributed within Atari and their coin-op division from like about 1978 up until about 1984, 85. So, and there's loads of archives. I mean, I've not been through them all, but I'll put a link in the show notes, obviously. You just look through and basically get a feel for what was going on in the company at the time. And like anyone that gets internal emails, there's loads of bitching and like arguments and all that in it too. So,
and I guess that's from the start, right?
So
that's from when they were using like baking trays in the Pong machine to collect the coins. And it was, you know, really all cheaply made. And
well, Steve Jobs worked for Atari for a bit.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, he did, didn't he? Yeah, before Apple, so it might even be some classic Steve Jobs stuff in there. But I think, you know, there is a lot of material to get through, but I think it's worth giving it a download. I'd be interested to see if there's any stuff around, you know, the E.T. kind of era, what we were talking about then.
That would be good.
It was such an interesting story, because Atari were obviously a massive company, weren't they, at the start of video
games? They were, and they were also doing lots of weird practices that companies were doing to put off the competition. Mm-hmm. So with the arcade machines, they were putting in fake serial numbers. So they were putting on the back, you know, 2007 or whatever.
Make it look like there's more than the worst.
Yeah, it was like the seventh machine, you know.
Yeah, so it'd be interesting, you know, get the lowdown on such a legendary company, always getting, you know, an inside look.
Yeah, yeah.
It's always quite exciting. So, they're all available for download. There will be links in the show notes. And a new Nintendo Entertainment System game.
Yes, okay. I've heard about this for charity, apparently. What was the game again?
I think it's called something like Germ Squishers or something. Yeah, Germ Squashers.
Squashers.
Now, yeah, what it is, it's basically all the proceeds for this are going to go to the Children's Miracle Network, they call. So it's a kids' charity in America.
Kind of like Make-A-Wish, is it?
Yeah, that kind of thing. I mean, it's quite interesting. The game, it looks like, you know, pretty bog-standard platform, but it's going to be out in a physical cartridge, not only for the NES, but also they're bringing it out on the Super Nintendo and the Genesis/Mega Drive as well, and new platforms like iOS and Android too, with all the proceeds go into the charity.
That's good.
We mentioned this last week, though, that a lot of companies now are actually developing for these old platforms to get coverage.
Yeah, to get coverage. And also because they're not restricted by licensing laws. They don't care about if people are developing for these old platforms, whereas if you bought one out for the Xbox One, you'd have to pay a massive fee to get that content on there. But Dreamcast, Mega Drive, no one cares.
Yeah, just chuck it out, people will buy it, people will make a profit, whether that's charity or a company, so...
It does work, because, you know, this is getting coverage in all the gaming websites and stuff, you know. And I wonder how much of the sales are actually on the old platforms, whether, you know, the iOS and Android ports actually sell more.
Yeah, maybe there's like 50 or 100 on the old platforms and then 10,000 on the iOS.
this year we mentioned that it's been like the biggest release in 2015.
Yeah.
More Dreamcast games came out last year than since 2002.
17 independent ones.
Wow. Yeah. 17?
Yeah, yeah, 17 the last 12 months.
And they were all, you could physical copies.
Yeah, all printed as well.
Wow.
It wasn't homebrew, you know.
Yeah, not homebrew, actual physical came out. Yeah, because I've watched the video the other day and it was like the top 10 Dreamcast games and it was going on about excluding all the games that should have recently come out because some of them are so good, but they're not original. They're not original Dreamcast games, so they had to exclude them all. So no, it's definitely worth checking out.
Yeah, there was always this issue with the Dreamcast of titles that were promised as well. You know, they'd kind of be like Unreal Tournament and all of these Counter-Strike. There was a big thing where they were trying to bring Counter-Strike, and then you'd always have these like dodgy versions that would come out.
Yeah, definitely. No, I have fond memories of the Dreamcast, you know. You know, I thought it was a brilliant console, but to find out that all these games are coming out of it has kind of sparked my interest, so I'm definitely going to check that out.
Yeah, I've got one of these SD to ISO things on the back, and you can put homebrew games on there and stuff, but then they've also got this Bleemcast, which was
PS1 games.
PS1 games.
I think I've seen that as well, yeah.
Yeah, you can play PS1 games, and a lot of the time the graphics are actually improved.
Yeah.
Like the quality.
Upscales them, yeah.
Yeah, that's but sometimes good. Lots of bits are missing, so watch out.
Well, there was one game that I saw for the Dreamcast. Have you heard of Propeller Arena?
No.
And that was meant to be, it's basically a little game where you fly planes around and stuff, but I think it was going to be one of Sega's final titles on the Dreamcast.
Yeah.
But it was all ready to go, and they're going to release it like in 2001, early September. And I think just before it hit the shelves, 9/11 happened.
Oh, God.
So they pulled the game, even though it was completely finished pretty much. I think maybe in one of the maps you can fly around New York and stuff.
Yeah.
So they didn't think it was appropriate, but you can actually get it to download now. And it is, you know, it is considered one of the probably the best flying game on the Dreamcast.
Oh, wow.
So,
well, that's my dream. My dream is to get the Dreamcast set up. Yeah. Because you can get VGA to HDMI ones at the moment.
I've got a VGA cable for it, but I think I want to get. Because we mentioned last week that there were so many kind of, you know, wacky and eccentric kind of, you know, peripherals for the Dreamcast. Yeah. I bought a fishing rod recently.
Yeah, Dan with his fishing rod.
That's a funny sight.
But I think the quality that the Dreamcast can go to is 480i.
Yeah.
Which is, like, quite good, you
That's
know?
Pretty good for, like, technology from 1999. Like,
definitely.
That's quite impressive. I'm quite impressed that I didn't know that either. So.
Yeah, so you can get the, you know, VGA box from eBay and then just go straight onto that.
With the original Xbox, you can actually get component cables for that, and you can run that in 720p.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so...
That's good, with the media centre.
For the Wii, the component you can get the Wii in HD, have you seen how expensive that is on eBay?
Is it really?
Yeah, gosh, yeah, a lot of money just to get your Wii.
That leads us into the next topic, actually, which is eBay price insanity.
Ooh. Now,
this is obviously a subject that, you know, rages on the forums and stuff. What do you think, Ravi, price driving?
I've seen it happen horrifically, but it's actually been for items that I've owned. So I'm pretty happy.
I was going to say, it depends what side you're on, really, isn't it? It's either a negative or a positive thing, so...
Yeah, if you're buying, then...
Yeah, no, not good.
But, for example, like, last year, I bought a copy of Theme Park for the CD32 for, I think it was £5 off eBay boxed. And I've just looked today, and there's one going for £45. And that's, like, you know, standard bid. This isn't... Buy it now. But
didn't you get Akira as well with a T-shirt or something? Wasn't that?
Yeah.
How much does that go for normally?
Oh, 250 or something. But it's very strange. It's like these people list these items really highly.
Mm-hmm.
They'll hope someone will catch and they'll catch. And then everyone else who wants to, how much is this worth? They do a search for the sold items.
Yeah.
And they see it sold for that price. They start listing and it's like, just keeps increasing it and increasing it. So
I'm just having a look now and it's just like one game that comes to my mind straight away. It's not the rarest game in the world, but Street Fighter Alpha 2 for the SNES.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, I'm just looking at it now and it's just like, I actually have a copy of this game and I was really lucky. I got it at Car Boot for about 50p.
Wow.
Yeah.
And I took it into the local game shop and they offered me about £30 for it. But on eBay right now, it's £90 buy it now. And it's just hilarious just scrolling through because there's so many different prices for it. You know, suddenly it jumps up to £110 and then somebody only wants £21.99 for it. And it's just, what possesses you to think, you see somebody selling it for 30 quid, yeah, maybe it's not in as good condition, and you think to yourself, well, mine's a bit better, I'm going to try and bang that on there for £110 and hopefully some schmuck buys it.
You just think maybe there's like, you know, some millionaire kid who's bored one day and he thinks, I really want that game, I'll buy it for 300 quid.
That's what I think, I think it's, you know, you'll get these frivolous people that will be like, oh, I want to get into retro collecting, and then they'll just buy up everything that yeah. took years, they years just, to
just,
amass.
They just know. Find out what games are the rarest, you know, which games are going to be the most impressive that they own, and just kind of blow hundreds of pounds on it.
That's what I've kind of started doing with the CD32 market, because I can see the prices are increasing so much that I've had to get the rare ones first. Mm-hmm. And then yeah. just get the general ones.
It's something know. I've thought about in the past as well. Like when these games come out, like I can remember a couple of years ago, Lost Odyssey for the Xbox 360. Yeah. And I thought to myself, this could catch on. This is by Square. This game could catch on. It didn't catch on, but it could maybe in 20 years' time. If I buy a copy of this now for £10, this game could be worth a lot in the future. But no, like what Ravi's saying is, you know, you want to get the rare ones
get the rare
away.
Ones first. And yeah. Then, yeah.
Well, I think, you know, like PS2 games, that they've got to be the next thing that kind of goes up in value.
Yeah.
So I often think, should I start buying? She seemed like 50p and like, you know, yeah. that's entertainment, trying to get rid of them and all that. But
I just don't see it going down. Because it's just this cycle of eBay selling, marking up stuff, you know, it's selling for that price. It's just going to keep going.
It is just going to keep going. I mean, I started trying to get back into retro gaming about 10 years ago now, and I went through a crazy phase. And now looking back at it, you know, I was just looking at how much you can sell some of this stuff, and it's like, I could sell it for double for what it was
yeah,
back then.
That's it,
and that's only in 10 years, so what's it going to be in another 10 years? Is it going to go one way or the other?
Like, Dan bought an Amiga 4000 last year.
Yeah, £300 I got mine for, which was actually a bargain, though.
That's
an
absolute bargain, yeah. because last year they were listed on eBay for, I'd say, about 6 to 8.
Yeah, now they're about 1,000.
1,000 yeah. to...
What was
well,
that, Amiga 4000?
Yeah, top of the range Amiga. It was one I always wanted as a kid, but I mean, you know, there were about 2,000 or 3,000 when they were new.
Mm.
But, you know, the rate's going now, they're going to be that again in like 2 or 3 years, aren't they?
It's That's
like,
it, you know.
But I'm looking here, there's a Commodore 64 with disk drive, £550.
Gosh.
It's like, I remember when you could get that, they couldn't give them away, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like back in like the early 2000s.
Well, there's certain sellers that have stocks and supplies of lots of stuff and then put it up on eBay. I'm not going to say any names. But,
we all know they are.
Yeah. Guiana Sisters on tape for £10,000.
It's silly money. Yeah. Silly money.
But yeah, it's like, I don't know. It is a shame, though, because, you know, someone like you, Ravi, you want to get your full CD32 collection, but there are, I imagine there are certain titles in there that you probably will never get.
Yeah,
you?
There's a Thomas the Tank Engine pinball, which I'm not willing to spend £250 for a Thomas the Tank Engine game.
Would you even play it? That's the thing.
Yeah.
No.
This one will look good on the shelf, don't you? Yeah. It's the same with me. And like, you know, I started collecting for the Jaguar last year. The Jag is kind of, well, I guess the CD32 is probably similar. It's got quite a small library.
Mm.
I think there's about 70 games on the Jag.
Yeah.
And I've probably got about, you know, 30 now, so I'm about halfway there. But there are titles like, there's like a Mario Kart kind of clone for it called Atari Kart. But, you know.
But then you get into the different area, don't you? Because you've probably got loose carts.
Yeah, well, yeah,
what,
not
if
all
it was
boxed
with manuals, you know, sealed, you know. It's...
What kind of collector are you? You may have all 70, or, you know, maybe getting there, but are they all boxed? That's, yeah. That's yeah. Good,
but like, you know, we said last week, I'm not really, you know, a heart of game collector, but it's just because there isn't an EverDrive or anything for the Jaguars. It's the only way you can play the games is to get the original carts. Yeah. But going back to, you know, we were talking about homebrew before, I've got a CD attachment for my Jag, and actually, I think there's only something like 7 commercial games came out on the Jag CD. But since then, there's been about 42 have come out, like homebrew and indie games and stuff for it. So,
well, I've found, like, if you can get these websites where they're remaking, like, official conversions and stuff, and there's a CD32 one where they're doing unofficial conversions at the moment.
Yeah,
they're,
yeah.
They're adding in...
free, aren't they?
Yeah, all the FMV intros in that weren't in there before. They're, like, Mortal Kombat has... Mortal Kombat film in it on the intro.
Did they take it off the Mega CD version, didn't they, and put it over?
Yeah, yeah.
I can imagine the quality is...
oh, it's shocking, yeah. The James Pond intro is like...
Oh, James Pond, oh, what a game.
It looks like a VHS tape that's been transferred about 40 times, yeah, but it's cool that they can do it. And I mean, you know, it's, I think it's stuff that they should have done back in the day, really, but developers then, they're probably going to deadline that. Oh, we'll
it's kind of like the passionate geeks are sorting out all their stuff they didn't finish at the end.
Well, exactly.
Let's go back and fix it.
Yeah. Like taking them 20 years, but they got there. I mean, even on the Atari Jaguar CD, they're bringing out Another World for it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, you've spoke to me about that a few times.
Yeah.
I mean, do we need another port of Another World? You tell me. But
I think, you know, the original developer, he always was a fan of the Jag, but because it was a commercial failure, he never actually got around to releasing the game on it. So it was something he wanted to do for like 20 years.
Is that something he's doing himself now?
Yeah, so he's behind the project as well.
Oh, wow, that's brilliant.
They brought out some of them on, you know, fully boxed with the carts and all that.
It's amazing because Another World was such a good game.
Mm-hmm.
but it's not really talked about that much.
Yeah,
is
I
it
only
these
ever played.
Days,
I played it on the SNES as a child, mm-hmm. and then I've played it with Dan on Amiga. Mm-hmm. Much better on the Amiga.
Yeah. That was his first platform, I think. The Amiga wasn't.
Yeah,
it?
Yeah.
The original platform for
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I think looking back at it for the time, it looked best on Amiga as well. Mm-hmm. Like at the time,
I think. You're saying the JAG version's quite nice.
Yeah, well, the 3DO is probably the most impressive 3DO, version I've played. Yeah, that's...
I've seen that one.
Of course, they did re-release Another World last year on Xbox Live.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
It was called, I think they called it like HD or something like that, but it was basically the Amiga version that was kind of a little bit sharper.
More nicer textures.
But it wasn't really, the textures were the same. Okay. But I thought they missed a trick, they should have done the 3DO port really, because that fully rendered backgrounds and, yeah, you know, yeah. and this even had more sound effects and stuff as well. It is a really nice version of it, but the fact that, you know, next to nobody owns a 3DO, very few people get
true.
To play it, you know
yeah.
what I mean? And our final topic this week then, new coloured Commodore 64 keycaps.
Oh.
Now, what this is, I don't know if you've seen these, but a lot of people recently have been putting out these kind of remade cases for old systems. Mm. So we had, there was an Amiga 1200 one that was done. They actually did the Commodore 64C. So what they do is a Kickstarter, and I think these guys have actually got the original moulds.
Yeah, they've got the moulds from the factories, and they've actually talked to some of the original engineers and said, oh, how do I do this bit, you know?
But apparently I've heard that these moulds, I think they found the Commodore 64C ones, and they were that heavy that the factory was either going to throw them out, but you couldn't put them in your house, it'd fall through the ceiling. But that's how much these things weigh. So it actually costs a lot of money to get them moved and get them all set up in a factory environment again. And they've been doing Kickstarters. I think the Amiga one went for about like $10,000 or something.
Well, I think there's currently three Amiga ones. There's the main mold one.
Yeah.
There's also Lorian Panji, who's doing the keys.
Okay.
As well, so he's doing custom keys in all the different workbench colours and stuff like this. Mm-hmm. And then there's another recased moulding one then as well. So, and they've actually got official licensing from Amiga Inc., which is amazing.
Bill McEwen
and crew, which is, I didn't even know they were still alive.
I think he's a truck driver now.
Yeah. And they got it so they can actually put the Amiga name on the board.
But it's really cool. I mean, you know, obviously you guys have got, you know, classic systems as well. You find, I know there's retro writing, but have you got any yellow systems?
Yes, I've got a yellow SNES, which looks lovely in its cabinet. But yeah, no, definitely. And have you ever actually seen how you can actually un-yellow them?
Like, yeah, retro writing, isn't it?
Yeah, is that what it is? Yeah,
I've writing, got a video on my channel, and I'm not using retro bright. I'm using B-blonde, which is a ladies' blonde
peroxide. That's what I was on about, the peroxide, the hair dye, and you put it in like a sealed bag, don't you?
Yeah, that's
and
it.
Try and clean it
yeah,
all
yeah, you
off.
Can do the keys with that as
yeah.
well.
You'll see Ravi down the ladies' hair dye section, you know why.
<that's>
yeah. But because I mean, I've tried it with a few of my systems, not to the, you know, I probably haven't had the success that you've had, but I did actually buy one of those, you know, the black lights.
Yeah,
So I've got one of those now that came probably about 3 or 4 months ago. I've not tried it yet, but I've got like an Amiga 600 that looks a bit like, you know.
Well, there's a big retro-bright backlash at the moment, which is a lot of people are saying, oh, it actually degrades the plastic over
time.
Yeah, I've heard so that. Now when everyone's promoting Retrobrite, they'll get flamed on another topic by someone saying, no, it's actually ruining your equipment. So, you know, it's a 50-50 balance thing.
But my Dreamcast at the moment is looking pretty grotty, you know, because I think there's a bit of a debate about what makes old consoles go yellow. I think it's kind of been settled. It's UV light, isn't it?
Yeah, I always thought it was UV light. That's what
It was a chemical called bromide, I think, that they put in, which was fire-resistant stuff. Same stuff they had on planes. So if you used to sit on planes when you could smoke in them, they'd say 90% of the air that you'd be breathing with this, like, fire retardant stuff in it. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So does that mean if your house burns down, your Dreamcast can survive then?
I was going to say, was that what was, like, going through their minds? Like, that's what's going to survive if your house burns down. Yeah. At least my Dreamcast and my Super Nintendo are okay.
Or maybe if the Dreamcast malfunctions.
There we go, yeah.
I'm going to set up in flames, I guess.
It contains the fire.
But basically with these new cases, you know, because there's this Commodore 64 keycap. So what it is, you know, they released some cases last year, and rather than having it the original beige or white colour, they've got, like, you know, bright red and blue and yellow.
They look fantastic, actually. They look really nice.
But it would be cool to see this for other systems as well, you know.
Yeah.
If you could get, like, a bright pink Dreamcast or something.
Yeah,
you know.
No, definitely.
Or what you could do is you could get this and put a Kira device in there, have a Raspberry Pi 2, mm-hmm. and have that in your original, well, new bright Commodore housing.
Keyboard. So it uses it as a keyboard on a modern machine, is that?
Yeah,
USB
so the Kira, you can mm-hmm. use it as an interface for your main keyboard. Yeah.
playing Fallout 4 on your Commodore 64.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, those big clunky keys.
You could be on the train, whip out your iPad, your C64.
Coolest kid in town.
Yeah. Well, you see these guys with their vinyl, vinyl. Why not?
Have you seen hipsters with typewriters?
That's a great blog, isn't it? Yeah, awesome.
Let's try and outdo them. Take some Commodore 64s on the train.
I'll see you in Starbucks next week. Right, guys, it's been an amazing show. Thank you so much for joining us, Joe.
No, thank you for having me, guys. I've really enjoyed it. Yeah.
And of course, all of these show notes of everything we've talked about will be available on the website, theretrohour.com. The podcast comes out every Friday. A little treat for the weekend, available on iTunes, very soon on the Google Play Store, and now on YouTube as well, because we've had some demand for that.
Yes, and I'd also like to thank Amigos Podcast for mentioning us. They said we could do something, you know, UK versus US perspective or some kind of
show.
That could
get brutal, couldn't it?
Yeah, so we'll arrange that.
Excellent. Well, we'll see you again next week, guys. And now we're going to hand you over to a fascinating interview with Paul Drury from Retro Gamer Magazine. You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and this week's special guest we are proud to have on the show, Mr. Paul Drury. Hello, Paul.
Hello, mate. Thanks for having me.
Now, Paul's been a video games journalist for how long now?
Been paid for it since 2002 for our local Nottingham Post, and then a few years after that I started writing for Retro Gamer, which I still write for both of those. So a few fanzines before that, if people are old enough to remember what a fanzine was.
Sadly, we are.
Yeah, right. Disc mags as well, they were the...
Disc mags, yeah, they were the days. I thought we'd start right at the beginning then, Paul. What first got you into gaming?
Really? God, you are starting at the beginning. I've got a very vivid memory of seeing the arcade game Boot Hill at Ripley Leisure Centre when I was learning to swim. And I don't think my swimming was particularly good, but my video gaming skills steadily improved as I used to put the 10p for the locker into Boot Hill. And ever since then, I mean, I was born in 1970, and, that means I've grown up pretty much. I mean, the first arcade game was kind of 71, Computer Space, so I've grown up alongside that. And it was definitely arcades that got me interested. I think listeners even, of a certain age, that was where you went to get your sort of first exciting hit of, you know, what was happening new with video games. And it was a little bit later than that I got a computer in the early 80s. A VIC-20.
Commodore
VIC-20, yes, I was a Commodore boy.
Space War was on the PDP-1, wasn't it? Which was a really...
The first computer space, yeah, you're right, was in the 60s. I'd once interviewed a chap called Nolan Bushnell who set up Atari. Mm-hmm. And he had this, what an interesting bloke, because he had this idea, you know, he used to play that at his university in Utah.
Yeah,
and then in the summer. Yeah, well, because you had massive computers, you know, it took up a whole room. And then he'd go to his sort of summer job in an arcade, in an amusement park with arcade. And he'd see all these people putting little coins in electromechanical machines and just thought, hang on, I wonder if I could put these two things together. And whilst it took quite a few years and lots of other people were involved as well. I've been lucky enough, to answer your question, is to grow up with video games, starting with arcades and in the home, and then never really stopped.
The arcade culture, though, especially in the 80s and kind of early 90s, that was where it was at, though, wasn't it? I mean, were you a regular? Did you frequent arcades a lot?
Yeah. It's more than just the games as well, is that they were our youth club. It was a place where you could go, where you were basically fairly unsupervised. And something exciting would happen every week, sometimes on screen. You know, I mean, I vividly remember the first time I saw a game called Donkey Kong. Mm-hmm. Going like, but you're not shooting. Why aren't you shooting? You're jumping? What's this nonsense? But also, there was always the dodgy bloke that gave out the 10p's. But apart from that, it was an unsupervised space for kids to intermix. And, you know, you had bullies there. You had kids all grovelling for 10p. But, you know, and it was just a way that you could have your own space. And I wonder whether... I mean, kids do have their own space now because they have a kind of virtual space, don't they? But interestingly, we, you know, the same people now that moan about kids hanging around, people my age that moan about kids hanging around on Nottingham Market Square, you know, they were the same kids that were hanging around in arcades, you know, like, seeing, has anyone got any fags? Has anyone got 10p for a go on Phoenix? You know, I think that's why you don't get this nostalgia. You're doing a retro show. Mm-hmm. You cannot have nostalgia unless you've, well, A, that you've had a gap, right? But also that you've had that many people doing the same thing and it being such a big salient part of their life. Like, so, yeah.
even we're different generations, and I would be playing in the arcades. Kids would have fags, and you know, there'd be bullies.
You see, don't tell your dad. Right, yeah, yeah.
But we'd be on Crazy Taxi. You know,
so of course. And it's, I mean, it is kind of sad that, I mean, you right up until the late 90s, you know, there was still an arcade scene.
It's when the gambling machines came, and I think that's a...
Well, you go to the seaside now, that's all it is, isn't it? It's front machines and quiz machines,
But yeah, so I do miss those days, because they were, you know, it wasn't just the games, it was also the space that you play in a public arena. I mean, even now, I'm excited if I ever see an arcade retro machine, of which there are quite a few in Nottingham, in pubs. Even though I've got all those games at home on my computer, is that, you know, playing Galaxian in a pub, it just transports you back to 1979. Except I can drink now while I'm playing.
Not have to do it secretly anymore,
Not anymore, no. Right.
So, obviously, like you said, you've seen many different eras. I mean, you've been a gamer consistently right through it. Are you still today?
Oh, God, yeah. I had this kind of lost years from, like, 1988 till about 92, where I went to university and got into, like, stupid things like girls and drugs and all passing things.
Waste of time.
Passing things. And then back then in 92, when I qualified as a teacher, is that I remember seeing... I still got my Commodore 64. I'd upgraded from my VIC-20. Mm-hmm. Gathering dust. And I remember I saw... Can you remember an old Atari console, an Atari VCS? They had, like, wood grain.
The original
like
woody one.
Yeah, and I just started work, so I got a little bit of money. And I saw one of these for sale in, like, a junk shop in Derby for, like, tenner. And I remember when I would be 9 and 10, you know, they were 200 quid, which is a fortune in 1979, 1980. And I remember really wanting one, thinking, oh, my God, these are, like, 10 quid now. So I remember buying one of them, which was a bit weird in 92, and taking it home, and then not only love it, and, you know, you could buy the games for 50p now, right, and playing Space Invaders and that, and there was that nostalgic rush. But also you saw other, I think it was the first time I realised that how that it had been a part of lots of people's lives, because people had come round, because I got my own house by then, well, a room in a house, and people come around and go, oh, my God, you got an old Atari. So then, you know, at that point, then I got a SNES, and then after that, you know. So apart from those sadly four lost years, which is sadly when the Amiga was really big, so... that's the one area where I will struggle a bit, right, with the Amiga. So when I'm interviewing people, I'm really confident with the 8-bits, and then the Amiga comes on. I was kind of like at university and getting into girls and stuff. But anyway...
The wilderness years.
Exactly, you know, thank God I came back, you know. So, yes, and of course I write about modern games for the Nottingham Post now. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I'm not one of these retro snobs. I never say things like, oh, games were better in the old days. We remember the best games from the old days. There was, for every... Manic Miner, there was 100 rubbish, look at me, not swearing, rubbish platform clones that if you played them now, you go, oh my God, did we used to play that? Yeah. Mm-hmm. You remember the best. Just like with music, you remember the best. Music was not better in the 60s. There was a load of crap in the 60s, but you remember the best. And so with games, you remember the best. And, you know, I'm absolutely sure that in 20 years' time, I'll be banging on how good The Last of Us was, right? You know, because it is, it's ace.
We had a discussion before of the fact that, you know, it's quite strange that gaming gets this kind of retro prefix on it when you're talking about classic stuff, whereas music doesn't and movies don't.
You don't say films. I'm really into retro films.
No, exactly.
However, I think that'll change. I'm confident. Because even now, it's seen less and less as a geeky thing. Like, when I bought that Atari in 92, it was like, yeah, that's cool. Why have you bought that? Right, you know. And, like, now, I think it's become a big enough part. I mean, the magazine I write for, Retro Gamer, we're now on... I mean, yeah, of course we're a niche, but, I mean, we've been going, like, 150 issues. Mm-hmm. And you get on, you know, you get sold in WH Smith, you're thinking, well, we're no more a niche than bloody Cross Stitch, or I don't know, some other, you know, magazines that have been going that long. So I do think, I think that's a very valid point. No one says I'm into, I mean, they might say about cars, maybe, I'm into, but with films, it's good film. With music, it's good music. I think that will happen with video games. Mm-hmm. I suppose the only thing is that video games are so tied up with technology. Mm. So, like, in the early days of film, I can see why you'd go, you know, the leap from silent black and white films to, you know, Technicolor and sound.
It was 100 years until film got sound, really, wasn't it?
Right, so, exactly. You know. Right. So there's obviously some huge technical things we jump through, and they're still happening with video games, right? But it's getting, you know, we're getting dangerously close to photorealistic graphics. Mm-hmm. we're it's interesting that the things that progress so much, like graphics, you know, but then you look at things that haven't progressed so much, like narrative and story, which are still, I love video games, but the amount that goes, don't tell me, is it a zombie one? I mean, The Last of Us, which is one of the best games this generation. If you look at the, it's still zombies and the end of the world. It just, it manages to bring humanity to that. But I think that'll, you know, maybe narrative's the next big thing.
Do you think that the kind of innovativeness has been a bit lost recently as everyone's falling into the same kind of genres?
Yeah. It's dangerous because it's too scary to go, because in the 80s we're doing groundbreaking stuff. Yeah, there was groundbreaking stuff, but there was loads of other people that just cloned someone else's idea as any. So, no, I don't think the innovation's lost at all. I think you have to look for it in different places. I think some stuff that indie games are doing now are really interesting, especially around narrative, actually, around the idea of, like, what's a game. Have you played Everybody's Gone to the Rapture?
No, I haven't, but I've seen videos of it.
I mean, that, I just absolutely love that, but it's not really a game. It's not really a game
in
that
school. Life is Strange, I played that. That was my favourite.
Oh, it's only good.
Yeah, I love it, but again, you know, it's an interactive movie, really.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, that used to be a real term of abuse, an interactive movie. It meant it's a game where you don't do anything. It's a bit rubbish. But, like, those things are really exploring ideas about... So, no, I'm really excited about video games still now. I often think I should be less excited, but I am still stunningly excited, and I hope I still will be when I'm 70.
Well, you mentioned one thing before, that when you got back into the Atari scene, you said your mates were kind of like, oh, it's a bit nerdy kind of thing, and obviously the attitude has changed over the years. Do you recognise a point when you think it did?
I would say something happened in the noughties. I don't think any before that, because you'd still sometimes have a conversation saying, are you a gamer? Right? And you still sometimes say that, but now it kind of means, are you really serious? You know, would you know some of the quiz questions that you get in the Broadway quiz? You know, could you name some, you know, how many Space Invaders was on the screen at the start? You know, that is, you've got to be pretty nerdy to know that. But, like, I think you used in the 90s say, are you a gamer? And it was a bit like a secret, like, you are? Wow, what are you playing? Well, now, I mean, everyone plays games. Now, it might be Candy Crush, but let's not get snobby, right? Candy Crush is very addictive. My wife and kids play that all the time, absolutely love it. Right, so you wouldn't really say, are you a gamer? It might be to what extent. It's a bit like saying, you know, do you like music? What music do you like? Oh, right, in that case, I'll tell you. So I think something happened in the noughties. With any historical change, it's not usually one thing that happens overnight. I think the Wii had a massive influence. I think, you know, getting your granny to play along with her grandchildren on a kind of level playing field was groundbreaking. I think the fact now that video games and video consoles sell so much. Back when I was growing up in the 80s, you know, you had one. You had a computer. You chose your side. You know, you either a commie or a specky, or for your, you know, an ST or an Amiga. You chose your side. You know, the only kids that had two were, right, posh buggers. You know, right? Who's going to have two computers? And, like, now the fact there's such a proliferation that it's, you know, you go into most houses and there'll be one, two, maybe more. And that's not counting the gaming devices, like on your phone, on your tablet, on your computer. So, like, the platforms has increased hugely. The way people play, I think, has changed. And whilst I'm still quite... I like a single-player game. I don't want a headset where American teenagers are threatening to teabag me. I don't want that. I want to play a game on my own and enjoy it and be really involved in it, you know. And so, you know, I'm still a bit old school, like, as you'd expect, like that. So, I'm saying the noughties. What do you think? Do you think there was a pivotal moment?
I think...
One, I'd say, was the time when it kind of grew up. Because I remember being a kid that, you know, before that, it was always video games were for... They kind of seemed like, you know, something that kind of prepubescent kids would play. And the PS1 came out, all of a sudden it had, like, you know, rave music soundtracks.
I think it was a bit before that. I think it was when the fighters were happening.
Mortal Kombat
and stuff like that.
A bit more grown up.
And they had, you know, Games Master was... pretty edgy on TV, and he'd be
all Dominic Diamond and his innuendos.
Yeah.
But actually, that's interesting, because you see, if you look at those dates, you know, if games started roughly about 1970, I know the roots, you're absolutely right, in computers and universities, but they started being commercial in the 70s. So they were for kids, you could argue, into the 80s. But then those kids, when it got to the 90s, were 20-somethings.
Yeah.
And so I think they were ripe for... playing Wipeout, having it, you know, that it did, people forget, it did seem weird. I remember I used to go clubbing in the 90s. I remember seeing a PlayStation. Now, I knew what one was because I was a gamer and I would use that word, but seeing it in that, oh God, what's it?
ISIS. I remember in ISIS they had Well, awful name now to say, but that was a name of a club.
Honestly, but, yes, we are not promoting. If only they'd got into gaming, we wouldn't none of this fundamental nonsense.
Would have been a nicer place.
Would have been a better place. Yeah.
They had a Ridge Racer unit, yeah, all set up with PlayStation, and it was all free. You know, it's like a promotion that they were putting PlayStations into clubs. Yeah.
Exactly, and I remember that. I remember how amazing it was. And then seeing, like, you know, cool, trendy people, not like me, who were out to go clubbing, playing this, and I was thinking something's changing. Yeah. Something's definitely changing.
Tony Hawk Skater in the skate shops as well, stuff like that.
Yeah, got all
those. I used to go to HSC and sit downstairs playing on a Tony Hawk.
Free gaming wherever you can get.
Yeah,
hey, Ravi, well done, you, right, yeah.
Has there ever been a system that you thought was going to be massive that wasn't at all?
All right, can I tell you first, I want to reverse that question. Okay. I remember very vividly, because it was at Screenplay, this festival that we used to run in Nottingham, I was part of, is that someone brought a Nintendo DS, right, and showed it us, and we went, this is brilliant. It will never catch on. Because it's it. I said, oh, look, you can touch it. What? How sweet. It'll be us four playing this. Mm-hmm. Right? And I remember when that became huge, I was massively shocked. So, like, you know, that should have been... I'll say something really obscure. There was an interesting British computer called the Enterprise, which came out in the mid-80s, and it was really forward-thinking, had lots of expandability, but it came out kind of 2 years too late. So there you go. And okay. No one will remember that. The Enterprise.
I'll have to look right, that up.
That could have been really interesting. And Britain, again, had such a fantastic history of producing computers. Mm-hmm. And then we kind of lost that.
That
impetus.
Was a shame, wasn't it?
Well, we were world leaders for quite a long time. I was part of this film, Bedroom to Billions, which looked at the British thing. And it's such an uplifting film in that look how, you know, this tiny little island of creative people and rubbish weather, so we're all inside playing around on the computers, desperately trying to make versions of Pac-Man's.
I never
linked
the two, but yeah, probably.
Yeah, rubbish weather, yeah. You know, we had all a real head start. And then, you know, with anything, business gets involved, which is fair enough. We wouldn't be playing games now if business hadn't got involved, right? But we certainly lost something in that. And, you know, America and Japan overtook us. And well done. I'm not like a nationalist like that. Mm-hmm. They produce fantastic stuff. But you still feel a little bit, oh, we had all them computers and all
that. You can see how it was like a cottage industry as well from that film. You know, it was really kind of... Bedrooms to Billions explains how small it was. Kind
people
of, you know,
don't understand. You know, like buying a game in the early 80s on a cassette, you know, you did not go to a shop. You sent off a postal order to someone. I interviewed this guy called Andy Walker, who used to run a company called Taskset, who did Commodore 64 games. And he said, literally, you just put an advert in and you'd get, like, postal orders. He said, me and my wife would sit here, right, and my little lad, right, it was like proper cottage industry in a cottage. And, like, you know, he'd put the tape there, I'd be recording and pressing record, put them in, and we'd post them off. And it was all on trust, all on trust, you know.
I remember they were even doing that into the late 90s with Special Reserve was one of the biggest mail order companies, but... No shop, nothing. It was all mail order games. Yeah.
Well, the Amiga had that with the public domain scene as well. I always remember that was kind of similar.
Yeah,
you'd see them in the back of the magazines and you'd...
The imports as well.
So obviously you said you started with the Commodore machines, the VIC-20 and the C64. I mean, it's a very difficult question for most gamers to answer, but what would you say has been your favourite platform then, the one that you got most fond memories of?
Whilst I'm not... The Commodore 64 and the VIC-20, it's very hard to choose. You never forget your first time, do you? I mean, actually, I'd make a big argument for the VIC-20, because sometimes I see those big, chunky characters. I don't know if you ever used a VIC-20.
Yeah,
Yeah, have you? Mm-hmm. Oh, they're lovely. Is that they were so... It was so distinctive. I think that's the other thing is now, if you buy a game on any modern console, it will pretty much look the same. Mm. But back then, it's like certain machines had very distinctive visuals. So, like, looking at some of those VIC-20 games.
Like the bleeding on the Speccy as well.
Oh, the colour clashed up. Yeah, don't talk to me about Sinclair, that stuff. I think that is because, I mean, I'm sure that I play some of them games and I play them for 2 minutes. I mean, some of my favourite games, Spiders of Mars and Cloudburst, and they were just great. But I'm sure now you look back and go, I can't believe that I love this so much. Or some of the, I tell you, the lost genre of text adventures, that was a huge part. One of the first persons I ever interviewed for Retro Game was Scott Adams. Mm-hmm, in fact, he was the first person I ever interviewed. And it was a bit like I thought, I could stop now, because he's my hero. And like, you know, if you look back at those games, which again, some of you listeners, I would hope, remember the idea of playing a game with no graphics, just text. And I realised going back to play them, there was such minimal, terse text. And yet, the places that it conjured up. I remembered exactly playing a game called The Cat. I could remember the bed, and I could remember the villages out the window. I could remember the dumb waiter. And looking back, that was like one sentence, mm-hmm. and yet it managed to create something in your life. So, favourite platform. You know what? I would probably have a VIC-20, even though I know that that's what I should say is a SNES, mm-hmm. which I'd have far more fun with.
Yeah.
But I'm a hopeless romantic.
But you're probably like me. I mean, my first system was a Commodore Plus 4 that my mum and dad.
Oh, that is obscure.
In the late 80s, you know, my first machine, I was about 7 years old. The VIC-20 was probably similar. You get a game, and you look on the back of the box, and it would show you the screenshots, and then very small at the bottom, with a little asterisk, it'd be like, maybe from different platforms.
Machines, hang on. Yeah. I mean, that whole set of screenshots arriving, before that, it was just, you know, often hand-drawn or elaborate descriptions, which, like you say,
which
seldom actually lived up to what you end up playing. But actually, I'm not sure that's true, because you brought... You still do now, I think, but you know, you bring a good game makes you bring something of yourself, mm-hmm. And that's why it engages. Whether it's, you know, BioShock Infinite, you know, you bring a lot of yourself to it. In just the same way that back then, you know, you brought a lot, partly because the graphics were. But the thing is, people forget, they say, "Oh, the graphics were rubbish." No, they weren't. They were cutting edge at the time you were playing them. So they weren't. No one said these graphics are crap. They're going to be much better in 20 years' time. Mm-hmm. No one said that. You were like, "This is amazing because it's better than last year. This is amazing." So people that say, "Oh yeah, we knew they were rubbish," no, we didn't. They were brilliant.
It's amazing how technology moves on so quickly, though, isn't it? I mean, you mentioned those early days of the graphics, and even thinking, you know, probably 20 years from now, the graphics they might not look as dated, I think, because we're at that stage, like you said, where it's near photorealism now. But you even look like back to the PS2 at the time, like it was jaw dropping to me. Now you look back, and it's like, you know, standard definition and 4x3. A lot of the games.
You're right. You go back and play only that. Only one or two generations go and go, "Oh God, it's a bit rough, isn't it?" Where we didn't say, because, you know, it went incrementally. Right? And to be honest, you just said there is that I'm sure we'll look back in 5 years' time and go, "A bit dodgy. Look at that face. That was really weird, doesn't it?" You know.
Were Lara Croft's boobs really that triangular?
It is quite scary, isn't it? Yeah.
Now, obviously, like you said, you've been writing for Retro Gamer for many years now. Does the success of that magazine ever surprise you?
Yes, of course it does. Yeah, and we did when it first came out. It was produced by a different publisher, and it got to issue 18, and then the publisher went bust. I would like to point out, I don't think to do with Retro Gamer. I think that was doing quite well. And I thought, well, that's the end of that little ride. And I remember feeling really sorry and thinking, I wonder if it'll rise again. Well, who knows? In another 20 years' time, someone will have a go. And then this other publisher, which we now Imagine Publishing, picked it up. And I mean, in this, it's interesting that whilst people say, "Oh, you're really niche and it's surviving," I'm thinking, well, no, actually, that maybe kind of makes sense, because we are appealing to an audience who broadly grew up where magazines were your source of news about video games.
Yeah.
You weren't going on YouTube, sunshine, were you? You know. So I wonder whether we've sort of built in a bit of a because people are people in the 30s or 40s are used to buying magazines. That's what they did, so it's quite normal. And I do know how many people save every single one.
Yeah.
Right. And then the only time I've ever been asked for my autograph was by someone said, "You know, will you sign my copy of Retro Gamer?" And it was only because they opened it up, because my picture's in the front. Yeah. And I went to write it, and I rather knew it embarrassed, like, you know, because my dad was there. It was at like a do, it was the launch event. And I said, "Oh, I've never been asked to do this before." And he just looked at me and went, "Not surprised." Took it and logged off. I was like, "Cheers, thanks for that, mate. Thanks a lot."
Not surprised.
Went up, yeah. So I am surprised we've gone this long. I'm also because I'm thinking, God, we've written about so many people. Mm-hmm. I tell you what's quite a proud thing is how often I see Wikipedia entries updated, reference to Retro Gamer, because we've actually talked to the that's a big thing, because, you know, anyone on the internet can write about any game now, right, and publish it. So you've got to have something different, which is, right, we always talk to the person that was involved with it or the people that were involved with it. And our editor, whenever he commissions everything, anything's like, "Who are you talking to? Who is it? Who is it?" Right, you know, and if you, "Oh, I managed to get the person who wrote this game or did the graphic," that's cool. Right, okay. And then, so I'm quite proud with that. So you feel that, like, you know, without getting all sort of poncy about it, is that you feel you're contributing a little bit to the record of this. I've even saved every single interview, because I always do them, I never do them on email, I always do them either face-to-face or recorded them. Mm-hmm. And I've had this sort of pompous idea that I've saved them all, thinking, you know, maybe when I'm dying, and some of the people that I've talked to will be sadly dead, is that I'll go, well, there's their voice, and I don't know. Yeah. Who knows, eh? Yeah. My donation to the nation.
Are they ever hard to track down, these people?
Yes. In the early days, right, there were some people that would have a presence. So there were some people that you could put their name in Google and they would have, in fact, actually wouldn't be, put your their name in Alta Vista or Yahoo, right? Yeah. Ask Jeeves, yeah. And they would have a website. So obviously you've struck lucky there. That's great. Scott Adams, the first person I interviewed, had a website. So I literally went, oh my God, he's got a website. And I remember emailing him and he said, yeah, I'd love to. He said, yeah, happy to talk. And I remember going a bit, like this. Okay, so some people are. However, right, is that most people aren't. And they also, this is the thing, I reckon if you've been a pop star in the 80s and you're used to have being, you know, people saying you're wonderful, even if 20 years people have forgotten you, I reckon there's a little bit inside you of those people think, I am still actually important, right? Now, the people I'm trying to track down, you know, didn't think they were, a lot of them didn't think they're important in the first place anyway, right? And in fact, are shocked and surprised when I go, I'm so delighted to speak to you, and they'll go, are you? I've recently, only a few weeks ago, a chap called Terry Pratt, who was the launch editor of a magazine called Computer and Video Games, which is a really one of the first in this country. It was the first kind of games-orientated
CBG,
computer.
CBG.
CBG, right? He was the first editor. So I managed to get in touch with him. Again, now, because I've been doing it for so long, other people go, I've met someone that you will want to know, or I know. So it's all networking, right? And he came with his wife because he wanted to donate some things to the National Video Game Arcade here in Nottingham. And he came with his wife and his daughter, who studies here. Right. And I went, oh, so nice to meet you. So it's deep. Can't wait to put these in. And he was going, well, I don't think anyone will interest. They will. They will be really excited, right? And his wife and daughter are like looking, like rolling their eyes, going, yeah, yeah, yeah. So we arrive at the National Video Game Card, like video game, okay. Four people call, Terry, how are you, Terry? Oh, it's such an honour. Oh, you're Lords of Midnight. You brought Lords of Midnight. Are you going to autograph it, right? And he's going, well, I didn't really know. And you could just see his wife and daughter looking at him in a different way.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And I told him the week after, saying, thanks again for coming. It was great, you know, that. He said, my wife has just, she's been going up in the attic looking for any old stuff for my computer video game days.
He
said, she looks as if, you know, he said, you know, yeah, exactly. Said,
I'm like, married to a legend.
People don't realise what they contribute. So to answer your question, to try and track people down, is that what I found very early on is who is most likely to know whereabouts people in the video game industry used to be working in the 80s where they are now. The person you're talking to that used to be in the 80s. So now I've got into the habit of saying, like, for example, Scott Adams, I go, are you still in touch with? And mention all the people I could remember.
Yeah.
And he said, oh, actually, yeah. And he put me in touch with a lovely bloke called Keith Campbell, who used to write the adventure column for Computer and Video Games. And I remember going down to interview him in Brighton, and he died the year after, couple of years after. And we just got his story in print. And, you know, I remember his wife sent a very moving letter saying, oh, we'd thought that was all behind him. That used to be such a big part of his life. And then it all disappeared. And you just reminded him how, you know, important his contribution was and how many people remembered you fondly. So, yeah.
Well, I remember with Screenplay Festival, Matthew Smith was one guy who'd been missing for a long time, and no one knew what was going on with him. And then this was one of the, I think, the first appearances he actually did.
One of the first. I'd seen him in London, which is where I'd met him. He'd gone to a video game event there, but then asked him, said, oh, do you want to come? And I think people didn't believe he was going to come until he literally walked through the door.
And then he was sitting in the cafe and everyone
it's Matthew Smith. You know, right? So, I mean, that was quite, I remember that. That was a really magical moment. I mean, I've seen him, I only went to see him last week in Liverpool. He still lives in the same house in Liverpool where he wrote Manic Miner and Jet Set Willy.
He was just a kid then, wasn't he, when he did it?
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, we've been talking about this on our podcast recently as well. You know, we covered the fact that there's a new Sega Mega Drive clone that, what is it selling like? It's selling 400% rise in Argos recently.
Really?
The Spectrum recreations as well.
Yeah, the Vega.
They're selling, I think it is one every 5 minutes.
One every 5 minutes of the new Spectrum clones.
Really?
What do you think of the fact that people are re-releasing these old systems now?
Well, people are only doing it because they think they can make money, let's be not cynical, just honest about that, okay? Mm-hmm. Because it's something that I care about, I not only enjoy doing, but I kind of, think I'm glad we're remembering where this thing has come from, so people don't think it was invented with the PlayStation. It was quite a good example. You know, these things have developed slowly, and the people behind them they developed and learnt on those machines in the 70s and 80s that then helped them when they were in the 20s could start making games that we enjoy. So I'm really glad that people recognise it's not kind of as a year zero, like nothing happened before that. So I really like that.
It also saves on room because you have, you know, the retro where you've got SNES cart, you can put in your Mega Drive cart as well and everything. So,
do you like the physical sensation of, this sounds getting all sexual, the physical sensation of putting a cartridge in? I mean, obviously you can play all them games on emulators, but do you like that?
This is, I kind of like it, yeah. It's, but I like putting in a VHS as well. It
do
feels
you?
Like you're,
you're
actually...
just weird, right? Yeah, so you like the physicality.
Like, that'll probably be massive again in 10 years.
Yeah. Oh, well, actually, that's quite interesting. Yeah, that's quite interesting.
Well, they've just stopped Betamax production, haven't they?
Which is crazy. Yes. 2 months ago or something. Yeah. It was bigger news that they were still making Betamax.
Yeah, so they stopped.
It's still used in professional video.
But Paul
it's
makes
crazy.
An interesting point there, though, emulation versus the real deal. I mean, do you have many old systems still, or do you mainly use
Yes, emulation? But don't tell my wife. Yeah, yes, I have got loads of them, and some of them are really special. I mean, I don't know if you ever played a Vectrex, which was like a Vector console.
Before, yeah.
I mean, some of those you can't get the same unless you've got the actual hardware. It's a beautiful thing. I do fetishize a bit about having the real thing, which is stupid because, you know, oh, it is an interesting one. You know, like, I mean, I've also got loads of vinyl. But again, I'm not one of those people that goes, yes, but you see the vinyl, you can hear the nuances that you can't get on a CD. Yeah. And I'm like, I'm listening to Sonic Youth. I don't really think you're going to check. You know, if I was listening to Elgar, maybe, right? But I'm not. So it isn't. Video games are an interesting medium in that, you know, you can play pretty much exactly the same thing, but not on the original hardware. In fact, not exactly, almost, you know, it's digital, you know.
But there
is something about the controls. I would say that's different, is that there's something about standing up with a joystick in a smoky pub. God, they're not smoky anymore. Wish they were smoky anymore. Play it, vapes coming over here. Playing that. That is something different about the control thing. Go on, sorry, Ralphie,
I was going to say, just with the Vectrex, every single retro show I've attended to, all the technicians go crazy as soon as someone brings a Vectrex. They're like, yeah, we don't want it to drain the whole power for the whole building.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you ever want to send them into a fit,
But I think, you know, with, for me as well, I mean, I love the Amiga. That was always my main platform. But there is something about, you know, the click of the floppy disk drives and the actual... the mouse of the Amiga and the keyboard.
So that's it. Yeah. Something about taking you back. Yeah. I mean, for some people, if you listen to the tape loading sound of games on Spectrum or Commodore 64 with that horrible... I mean, like, you know, for me, that, oh my God, I'm 12 again, desperately trying to get the volumes right so the bloody thing will load, right? Because it takes 20 minutes, right? Yeah, and they'll have to start again. So those things, they're not to do with the games, they're to do with childhood. And there's nothing wrong with that. And I kind of like that as well. And it's very hard to disentangle, you know, whether it is just this is a great game, right, or whether this is part of a childhood, and I miss that innocence, and that's difficult. Well, maybe you don't have to.
I even use a CRT monitor, you know, just for that original feeling. It didn't look right. I went through about 6 or 7 different LCDs. Didn't look right. Yeah. Went to my mum's, got my old Philips monitor from the early 90s out, and the games. I thought, this is how I remember playing these games. You know, it was being transported back in time.
It's strange though, because even like the 56k dial-up sound,
yeah,
that will take me back.
You start romanticising about the 56k dial-up sound, something's gone wrong, Ravi. Yeah. Something's
wrong. You look at that on YouTube; it's got like 2 million hits. Well, Paul, thank you so much for joining us. It's been fascinating.
Good luck with your endeavour. It's been an absolute pleasure, and I really, really wish you well.
And obviously, we can catch up with you in Retro Gamer magazine. What's your next article?
The next one, actually. The one that will be coming out in the next issue is all about a chap called Walter Day, who used to work for Twin Galaxies. In fact, this is actually... Can I finish on this?
Yeah, right. Please.
This article, so it'll be out at the end of January, so a couple of weeks, is that he has produced... trading cards, which are very big in America. I mean, in this country, we kind of associate kind of football stickers you used to swap in the
Panini,
80s and 90s. Yeah, Panini, exactly.
Chinese.
Well, he produces, that's right, it's all coming back, right? So he produces these trading cards, and he's put lots of famous video game players, video game designers, and I interviewed him about them, and I said, have you got many Brits? And he goes, oh, yeah, a few, but not enough. So when this article comes out, we're going to ask readers of Retro Gamer and anyone who will visit our forum to vote on who they think ought to be recognised from the UK as contributing towards the culture of gaming. And then he's going to get them printed.
amazing.
So, so my vote's for Jeff Minter, I'd like to point out.
Oh, absolutely.
The next issue, so come on, vote for who you think are the biggest contributors to the British video gaming culture.
Look forward to reading it. Thank you very much, Paul.
Thank you. Good luck.